Today's keishel will be on case 72 in the Book of Serenity. 72 is entitled Zhongyi's Monkey. Introduction: a battle of wits across a river, hiding the army, concealing the troops. Face to face, they hold each other up, the spear of reality, the sword of truth. That is why patched robed monks esteem the great function of the whole potential. From relaxation into urgency, try to spit it out in the open. Yangshan asked Zhongyi, "What is the meaning of Buddha nature?" Zhongyi said, "I will tell you a simile. It's like putting a monkey in a room with six windows. When someone outside calls it, 'Simeon, Simeon,' the monkey then responds. In this way, when called through all six windows, it responds." Yangshan said, "What about when the monkey is asleep?" Zhongyi got right down from his seat, grabbed and held Yangshan, and said, "Simeon, Simeon, you and I see each other." Verse: freezing sleep in the snowy room, the year about ended. The recondite ivy gate does not open at night. Groves and forests withered in the cold. Look at the changing conditions. The spring winds blowing stirs the ashes in the pipe. So this is day 6 of our 7-day session and day 4 of the 5-day session. And some of you arrived for the weekend last night, and I want to thank everybody for coming here. What we're doing, Sesshin, is really the heart of Zen practice. So, you know, it's essential for people to practice on a regular basis from day to day, but what we're doing here, sitting for 8 or 9 hours a day, is really where liberation really happens, where transformation really happens. So thank you all for participating and doing so very well. You know, today I looked around the Zendo and I saw people sitting absolutely still in deep samadhi, and also online. You know, the beauty of the Zoom mechanism is that I can see people completely. You know, it's not a dark room. I'm just looking at somebody sitting motionless for an hour and a half. So very nice work. So this koan is really almost incomprehensible without some context. Basically Yangshan asked his teacher, Zhongyi, "What's the meaning of Buddha nature?" And Zhongyi says something really weird. Now, if somebody said, "What is Buddha nature?" you might say, "Oh, Buddha nature is this radiant intelligence inside all of us, see? And that this is occluded or concealed by our karma. But, you know, through Zen practice, we bring it out, see?" So that's what we might expect him to say. But instead he says something, you know, Zhongyi says something really weird. What is Buddha nature? And he says, it's like putting a monkey in a room with six windows. And when someone calls it, Simeon, Simeon, the monkey then responds. In this way, when called through all six windows, it responds. So, I mean, the six windows are the six senses, okay? So basically, in Indian and later Chinese Buddhist thinking about the mind, there were, about the senses, there were six senses. So, you know, sight, taste, touch, smell, and hearing, and then thinking. Okay, the thinking mind is also thought of as a kind of sense. So basically, it's saying, tell me about Buddha nature. And it says, Buddha nature is like a monkey in a room and looking out through the six windows. So it looks out through our senses. And when somebody calls it, it looks through the window and responds. Now, again, this just seems like unspeakably weird. Until you begin to think about early Buddhist teaching, you know, early Buddhist teaching says that human beings have a monkey mind. Monkey mind. This is, you'll hear this all the time, right? So often in courses, introductory courses on meditation practice, you know, at some point this concept of the monkey mind will be introduced as a no-no, actually, as like a prohibited thing. So the idea is that when we sit down on the cushion in our ordinary consciousness, right, we do have a mind that seems incredibly undisciplined. You know, if you haven't meditated, you might feel like your mind is very disciplined, very well-ordered, and so on. But once you start to meditate, you realize it's like a madhouse in there, right? You know, you sit down on the cushion, you watch your breath, and especially at Sesshin, right? When you practice at home and you sit for, say, 20 minutes or half an hour, that's a beneficial practice. But what's happening is basically it takes about 15 minutes to have a deep relaxation response. And then after that deep relaxation response, you begin to enter a kind of light meditative state. In that state, it may feel like a release from your stress and a kind of openness, yeah? But actually, this is like very superficial kind of calmness or very superficial kind of state, because under the surface, your mind is still like a raging river, right? You just haven't sat there long enough to notice it. So when people come to Sesshin, you know, some people will say, you know, I actually sit better at home than I do at Sesshin. When I come to Sesshin, my mind is like a madhouse, you know. I'm watching my breath, I get to a calm, still place, and then all of a sudden it's like all of this stuff is coming up. And, you know, in early Buddhism, you know, these monks who were teaching meditation would with a smile, they would say, oh, that's the monkey mind. You need to tame the monkey mind, see? And they would say, what you need to do is, you know, just focus on the breath and ignore your thoughts altogether. And just be present with the breath and be in this moment. Just be in this moment. Now, there's some truth to this. This is advice I give people myself. So it's definitely true that if you sit down on the cushion and you just think, and it's so easy for beginners to do that, you get absolutely nowhere. So when people begin to do meditation, they sit down quietly, they watch the breath, and almost at once they'll think of something that's, you know, that's pressing or urgent, and they'll feel anxiety, and then the next thing they'll think of is a television show that something on cable TV they're interested in, and then they'll think about going to a Thai restaurant, and then they'll think about the first time they fell in love, and then they go back to their anxieties about their job, and then they think about sex, and then they think about money, right? So it is kind of like a monkey, right? It's like a monkey. And, you know, the monkey mind is saying, you know, you've probably seen nature films where you know, it'll have chimps, basically. And a chimp will find something on the forest floor that's interesting. And it will go up to the trees, and it will have it in its hand. And then, you know, on the way up the tree, something else will happen, and it just drops it, and it's like forgotten. And then it picks up something else, right? And then it you know, it goes to the next tree, and it finds a berry, and it drops what it had before, right? So the slander against monkeys, basically, it is that they're dumb beasts, and they can't focus their attention, right? And we don't want to be like a monkey, for God's sake, right? So the idea is, don't be a monkey, be a human being, and focus your mind in a beneficial way. And that means being in the moment, being in this moment, right? And not allowing yourself to follow your thoughts, but just taking one breath at a time, right? And we would say, be mindful of breath, right? Be mindful of breath. And in this way, we would say we have a disciplined mind, right? Now look, all of this is true to a certain extent. To a certain extent. But not ultimately true. See, not ultimately true. It's a preliminary teaching that's necessary so that people can go on to more advanced states of liberation. So if you're sitting on the cushion and you're thinking, that's not beneficial to you. You're just going through those loops over and over again, and you may be using your thinking to screen things off that are challenging, like the pain in your legs or the fatigue you feel. Or, you know, if you're working on emptiness meditation, when you call Mu, you may be encountering this empty space that's a little bit frightening. So, you know, it's naturally our inclination to want to think our way out of that, right? Another way to put it is to use ideas to screen off the openness that is so frightening to us, right? So there's a certain wisdom, a certain validity, a certain truth to saying you have to get free from your monkey mind and learn how to be mindfully present with this moment, this very moment. But actually, you know, that is in some ways a recipe for stupidity. In what way? Okay, well, there was a man named John Stuart Mill. I don't know if you've ever heard of him, but he was a British philosopher, and he was a genius child, and his parents taught him Latin and Greek when he was like five, right? You know, it's one of these cases, right? They set out to make the greatest genius of all times. His parents had a lot of dough, so they gave him a first-rate education. And he was like a super genius, right? And he almost committed suicide as a young adult because he was so, he said, nothing made me feel alive, right? I had all the world of knowledge at my disposal, but everything just felt dead. You know, nothing had any affective or emotional dimension. And what saved him from committing suicide was reading poetry. Isn't that interesting? And, you know, when he started reading poetry, he suddenly learned about emotions, which he had never learned, right? You know, and he began to have a life of feeling and empathy, and so on. And he went on to become this very great British philosopher. But you know, poetry isn't rational. It is kind of opening the doors to a part of our mind which is deeper than reason, right? Deeper than reason. Deeper than our ability to say what's good and bad, what's right and wrong. You know, poetry puts us in a state of uncertainty. You know, when you read a poem, especially modern poetry, you know, it doesn't make sense usually. You know, if you read a poem, some poems, like there's a poem by a guy named Wallace Stevens called The Emperor of Ice Cream. You know, you can read it 50 times and you're still not sure what the heck it means. And, you know, that's what's so liberating about it, right? It's like, what it really does is, you know, we go through our lives doing what we think is the right thing, the valid thing, the true thing, the rational thing. And, you know, all we're doing is going through these routines that are totally predictable. And, you know, whole parts of ourselves are closed off to us, you know, closed off. When John Stuart Mill started reading poetry, these parts of himself which had been closed off suddenly opened up. It's like it opened him up to, you could say, the unconscious mind, which he knew nothing about because he had lived his whole life in the conscious mind. And when he began to read poetry, it was like not only did it set free for him all these emotions that he did not know how to process, but it put him in touch, although he didn't have this word, with what we could call the unconscious mind. The unconscious mind. So, you know, early Buddhists were like John Stuart Mill, actually. You know, early Buddhists believed that the point was to not think wrong thoughts or bad thoughts or sometimes any thoughts at all, but to clean up our mind and make it a disciplined and orderly place, right? But there's a big problem with that. You know, not only did it, for John Stuart Mill, make his life meaningless and empty by closing him off from the depths of his own self, but, you know, we don't really know what is good and bad. We really don't know. We don't know actually what mental health is. We don't know. We don't know what mental illness is, actually. And so, you know, here's an example. I have a friend of mine who was raised in a Christian, basically like evangelical Christian. He's gay. A friend of mine in Seattle. And he was raised in an evangelical Christian home. And of course, homosexuality was considered like a crime against God, you know. So my friend, he wanted to be a good person. He wanted to be a good son and a good man. And he worked so hard to be good, but, you know, but he couldn't be good. He kept being drawn to the bad, you know. In other words, he was trying to be straight. He was trying so hard to be straight, and he was drawn to the gay. And the gay was sin. It was bad, see. So he went through hell, of course. Because, you know, he was working really hard consciously to be a good person, but underneath there was something asking him to go in a different direction, and he didn't want to listen. And, you know, his judgment was straight good, gay bad. See, it's clear. But you know what? You know, he had to free himself from that. And so, you know, we don't always know, or we don't really ever know what is absolutely good or absolutely bad. Society tells us this is good or this is bad, right? But you know, how do we know? We don't know. Nobody knows. See. So another example of how we don't know, you know, if you talk about, say, mental health. What does a mentally healthy person look like? Well, you know, one of my favorite poets is William Blake. And when William Blake was about 12 years old, he would hallucinate and see angels, right? And he told his parents, I ran into Ezekiel the other night. And he wasn't kidding, right? You know, fortunately, his parents didn't institutionalize him. They, because he was like a little genius. But he said, I talked to Isaiah, his parents actually realized he was like super gifted and not like cognitively normal person. And they let him, they had a publishing business. They taught him to be an engraver. He's one of the greatest poets in the English language, but, by many measures, he was crazy, right? But actually like a genius, brilliant, and not crazy at all, his things he says. So, we don't really know what mental health is. We don't know. We don't know what good means and bad means, right? And so, sometimes when we're using what we in Zen call the small mind to make decisions about things, we are prisoners of the prejudices of our society. We're prisoners of assumptions. And early Buddhists had no idea that there was such a thing as an unconscious mind. They thought that when you enter deep mushin and you got rid of thoughts, you were liberated. So basically, it's like if you're a monk and you're attracted to other monks and you're feeling tempted, right? You just have to go into emptiness and get rid of all your thoughts, and now you're now you're cured, basically. See, and that is that, and so just be in the moment, have no thoughts, and you will see everything without any illusion, any misleading coloration, and so on. But actually that's not true. When you go into mushin and you look around, your experiences are still colored by all kinds of things that aren't obvious to you because they're unconscious. So anyway, about 5 centuries after the Buddha died, there were these 2 brothers named Asanga and Vasubandhu. And they said, actually, just getting into a thoughtless state isn't ultimately liberating. Just being in the moment thoughtlessly isn't liberating. Because you have a deeper source of your awareness. They called it the alaya, the storehouse mind, or another way they called it the Tathagatagarbha, the womb of enlightenment, the womb of the Buddhas. So at the core of the mind, according to Mahayana teaching, there is this dynamic intelligence which we are not able to be aware of fully consciously, but which is speaking to us through the unconscious mind. And so Zen practice is all about not shutting off all mental activity, but basically entering emptiness and then looking at or inspecting our mental activity in a different way, in a different way. So the idea is not to end all thinking, but to experience thought, feeling, knowledge, and imagination in a different way. Yeah. Yeah. One way to think about it is that the monkey mind, so-called, the idea that the chattering inside of us is a bad thing is too simple a way of thinking about how the mind works. The Mahayana view is that all the time our enlightened consciousness is trying to help us wake up. And it's sending us images, thoughts, ideas, and they're all coming at us and we can't really hear it. We don't know how to process it. So what we have to do first is go into emptiness, right? And when we go into emptiness, we begin to experience, like we go to, we begin to experience everything in a different way. It's like little steps. Everything is experienced in a different way, little one step at a time, like one little. It's like you could say, when we go to emptiness, when we go to zero, we're starting to re-experience everything in the world, sights, sounds, taste, touch, but now in a different way. Now we are freed from the illusion that we are the center, the self is the center, and we begin to realize that the real source of everything is enlightened mind, enlightened mind. So what this means is that we don't want to shut off all thinking activity. We want to think in a different way. First, we go into Mushin, and then, you know, in Zen, the way we do this is to work with a koan. So we go into deep Mushin, and then, you know, maybe you're working with a koan like, unfair blows. There's a koan that the turning phrase is unfair blows. And in that koan, basically somebody's hit unfairly. And, you know, we've all been hit unfairly in life, you know. So the koan is one that most teachers give to almost all their students. And you sit down on the cushion, you go into emptiness, and you say, unfair blows, unfair blows, unfair blows, see. After a while, you know, instead of being in a serene place or this calm, grounded place, you might begin to feel disturbed. You might begin to feel, say, sad. You might not understand where this feeling of sadness is coming from, and you really can't reason it out, you know, but little by little, stuff starts coming to the surface. So you're saying unfair blows, unfair blows. This is like an unconscious cue, like a mantra, unfair blows. And, you know, you suddenly begin to feel sad or angry, you know. And then, you know, a little later as you're working with the koan, you might remember something from your past. So you might suddenly realize that, you had a dog that you loved and your father sold it. You know, that's something that happened to somebody who once sat with me. And it was like heartbreaking for this guy, you know, and he sort of, you know, your father is always right, right? He's your father, you know? But he had this heartbreak and anger under the surface. He'd sort of tucked it away somewhere. And as he's working with the koan, all of this stuff begins to come up, right? This had been coloring his life, all his life. This event was so important for much that had happened to him subsequently. And, you know, this person came into the Dokusan room and, you know, he actually cried and he said, you know, I love that dog, you know, and I've been so mad. I haven't been able to be angry at my father, but I'm so angry at my father. You know, basically in the course of the koan, in the course of the sesshin, he didn't end by saying, you know, I'm reconciled to my father. He left the sesshin with very mixed and conflicting emotions about his father. But the interesting thing was the last day of sesshin, he said, you know, I love my brother. And he said, you know, basically he said, we both had this father, you know, who did these things to us. And he said, you know, as soon as this, I get home, I'm going to call my brother and tell him how much I love him. You know, and I think what he's saying is that we both share this injury, right? We both share this injury, but, you know, opening this up again has made it possible for me to love my brother in a way that I, or to express my love for my brother in a way that I couldn't in the past. You know, it's like something inside him got unlocked, see? And when it got unlocked, what came out was, you could say, Buddha nature, right? It's like, you know, he was so locked up, and, you know, when he opened this part of himself up and relived this very terrible event, you know, what followed on that was this encounter with his extraordinary loving kindness, right? And he had been practicing Zen for some time, and he had been to this place of loving kindness before, and now he was going to take it off the cushion and out of the sesshin and go make contact with his brother, right? So this is the Zen view, is that you know, our thoughts and emotions and our memories and so on are not simply obstacles to be obliterated or eliminated, you know, or transcended or anything like that. What we have to do is to work through our obstacles and so on, and that means passing through them and encountering this radiant source consciousness, this womb of the Buddhas, as it's called. And we experience this as like an unconditioned love, unconditioned loving kindness. And, you know, this allows us to take all of these broken pieces of our lives and integrate them into this ever more complete whole, this ever more complete whole. So we're going, it's like all of these things have happened to us, and they're like a jumble under the surface. You know, we have an orderly life. You know, we have a house, we have a car, we pay our taxes in, you know, April 15th. We have a vacation once a year, you know, in the Baja or someplace, Cabo San Lucas, wherever. Very orderly. And that's the rational mind's world. Under the surface, though, our life is in pieces. It's all broken up. And it's not integrated, right? And thinking isn't going to solve that problem, that's for sure. But simply silencing thinking, saying, oh, don't listen to that monkey, see, simply silencing our memory, our thought, our feelings, that's a repression, right? That's not liberation. That's not what Zen is about. It's not what enlightenment is about. So, you know, little by little, we're using the mechanism of koan practice in our tradition. We're going down below the level of consciousness, and we're encountering these fragments, you know. And we're gradually putting them all together into this beautiful mandala, this beautiful mandala, right? And at the center of the mandala that the Tibetans like to create is like the Buddha, like enlightenment. And around the Buddha, all of these are these little houses and mountains and people dying and people getting born and, you know, clouds over the mountains and so on. all of this is integrated. You know, the mandala is saying everything in your life can be integrated, and that the integrator is compassion, is this radiant Buddha mind. And so the method of Zen is to, you know, first you could say emptying out, going to zero, and going to zero allows you to get access to the unconscious mind. And then as you go into the unconscious mind, there's all these fragments, and we're encountering all these fragments, but now we're putting them all back together in a new way to make the mandala of our enlightened life. So, you know, even your monkey mind, even your obsessive, you know, thinking, your neurotic thinking, your emotional upheavals, you know, all of this actually is your big mind, all of this expresses, you could say, a deep hunger for the kind of integration that we're pursuing here in Zen practice. It's not successful, right? Because it's not complete, right? It's not successful, right? You know, it's not integrated because you don't have access to the most important part of yourself. You know, we're all a little bit like John Stuart Mill, just living in our heads. When we begin to discover this unconscious mind, you know, it's frightening, and because it seems uncontrollable, and it also seems so fragmented. You know, if you're just meditating to be calm, great. But you know, meditation is frightening in a way, because, you know, once we go below the threshold of consciousness and we encounter the complexity of our unconscious, you know, it can seem overwhelming, you know. So, you know, basically, even children know this, by the way. This is why they like to keep the light on at night. Because when you go to sleep and you turn off the light, the unconscious arrives, right? With dreams and witches and whatever, right? Freddy Krueger, you know. So, you know, we all like to keep the light on. And early Buddhists just said, well, just keep the light on and everything will be okay. That's mindfulness, right? But actually, you know, when you turn the light off, you know, you turn the light off, and one ghost, one monster appears, and another monster appears, and another monster appears, but, you know, you really discover that they're not monsters. You know, they're all arriving here to help us wake up. Even the most terrible things in our life have the potential to put us in touch with our Buddha nature. And indeed, you know, the things that happen to us in our life, that those are the only doors we have to awakening. So we have to go through those doors. And we luckily have on the other side, we luckily have an ally, right? At the core of the mind is this Buddha nature in you and you and you and you and me. And it's helping us wake up at every step. So please trust the process. Introduction: a battle of wits across a river, hiding the army, concealing the troops, face to face they hold each other up. See, that's a normal discriminating mind. It's like an army, a battle of wits, two armies, you know, that's the normal discriminating mind. And he says, that's why patchwork monks esteem the great function of the whole potential. In other words, the great function is the activity of the dynamic unconscious, which is constantly creating the mandala. And we assist in that process by going into deep mushin and working through our obstacles. The great function of the whole potential, the whole being. You know, when we do zazen, we sit on a mat and we activate the energy system of the body. And it's a whole body process, right? Whole body process. So it's not just thinking, it's not just talking. It's a somatic. You know, people have done studies of what when you sit on the cushion in zazen, you know, it actually changes your endocrine function and your brain waves. And respiratory system is altered. All of these things, it's like the energy system of the body is being liberated and purified. This is why patchwork monks esteem the great function and whole potential. From realization, from relaxation into urgency, we go from relaxation into urgency. Try to spit it out in the open, bringing it to consciousness. Okay. Yang Shang asked Zhongmi, what is the meaning of Buddha nature? Zhongmi said, I'll tell you a simile. It's like putting a monkey in a room with six windows. When someone outside calls, Simeon, Simeon, the monkey responds. This is a joke. You know, the early Buddhists said it was a monkey mind, but it's not a monkey mind. It's an always enlightened mind, even when it doesn't seem enlightened. In this way, when called through the six windows, it responds. And Yangshan said, well, what about when the monkey is asleep? Zhongmi got right down from his seat, grabbed and held Yangshan and said, Simeon, Simeon, you and I see each other. On the surface, I'm Kurt, and you are, you know, Sandy, you are John. But, you know, At that Tathagatagarbha, that core of mind root, we're all the same. We're all connected there. It just seems that we're separate. Freezing sleep in the snowy room, the year about ended. The recondite ivy gate does not open at night. Groves and forests withered in the cold, looking at the changing conditions. The spring's wind blowing stirs the ashes in the pipe.